This is one of the most recent poems I wrote. I'd heard a fellow on the radio, and this is what I think his name was, and what struck me is that he didn't have a last name. No last name. Cap Baru waits. He has only one name. He's left his village where life became unlivable to wait in Calais. He has no last name. A family name suggests a past. A family name presumes a future, suggests people will search for your story, remember your life, tell tales of your exploits to grandchildren. What is life? If it is one day to the next, a linger aside the smog of trucks as they cough and wait to go to England. What is life but food, sleep, crap, and more of the same day on day? Who needs to be remembered for this? Cap Baru does. Perhaps his voice is like angels, the sweetest of nightingales, or his hands. They can build anything. His house, his tables, his bed, or amazing recall. He was the one to ask about village history, his own grandmother named the oldest back before the big war. Or he weaves, or he teaches, or he treats the young with particular care. Do we care? Or do we dam up the tunnel, forget we ever craved truffles, just bar the gate? Enough barbarians can storm any border. We can watch Big Brother celebrity dancing and believe otherwise. Cap Baru waits. This is a poem that developed out of people saying, oh, feminist issues are so beyond us. We don't need them anymore. And I came of age in the 70s. And the 70s were right after the 60s. And it was almost a time of great change where we almost had it. The 70s, love child of the 60s. First LSD in San Francisco, flower power and the Grateful Dead, then practiced, put to the test, and passing with our rainbow colors flying. We thought equal rights would pass as well, but Phyllis Schlafly screamed about dead military daughters, co-ed armies rife with sex. She had a husband to bake cookies for. Stamford, Connecticut, USA. A series of different bartending gigs. At one, we served gay couples, black and white, hetero couples, street people, business executives, muscular guys in the loading dock at Caldor's, all regulars. Oh, hey, Billy! Howard Beach race riots, still the awful future. And you haven't lived till Didi Ramon bums a smoke off you. And you haven't died till your boss feels you up when you polished the bar lamps. No cops to call. No laws were broken. His dropped pants. Hey, look, Rosie, no Bill Clinton-esque payday back then. No better way to lose that job than because you won't screw that boss. No finer way to not get hired at all than because you're female. Explained to your face in firm rejection at a sports bar. They hire girls now. These days I could sue Harry and his dropped pants and the Bobby Valentine's sports bar and any one of a number of engineering firms. I could do that now. But the stupidity of the 70s was its innocence, too. And somewhere in the smoke and frying egg rolls, Larry and his lover Billy walk in, and the bar yells, "Hey, Billy!" Years before cheers and "Hey, Norm." And the homeless guy argues with his invisible friend stealing sips of his drink. And the duck guys arm wrestle, and the businessmen drink scotch to oblivion, and one someday to eventual frostbite. And couples of any sex, any skin, any religion drink too much, and we drive home anyway, safe as houses, all us love children. The future, one happy, bright, utopic dream. This is when I was an older postgraduate student, and I would fly from Connecticut to Ohio every week to attend a 3-hour special seminar on reading behavior in the human skeleton. And I had gone to Yale my master's degree, but they looked at Lucy or modern baboons, and they didn't really look at, you know, modern skeletons. So I went off and I did this. And the local students would just give me one of their apartments for the night and then just leave me there and let me stay there, do the class, stay over, and go back to the next day. One night they said, "Rose, you should come out with us. We're going to the Carlisle Club." I went forth with the witches of Eastwick, and I, the accepted crone, danced and drank a beer and watched with awe the pulsing youth, blonde flapper's curls, or short, straight brown, or matte black, with Asian cheekbones. Each perfection in her own right, thin or voluptuous or athletic, each perfection, dancing, spells, weaving, watchers in with careless apathy, electric with power. Careless, joyous power. Watch as they dance as one, as close as molecules, this sensuous tango of friends, careless, choreographed perfection. I went out with the witches of Eastwick one night. They accepted, crone, pulsing, powerful youth. Oh, all of us, electric. As someone who works with skeletons, I think about my work on the way home. The dust of the dead. Usually I wear day-old clothing when I go to sort the bones, knowing that night I will hasten to strip off the dust of the dead. The decay of the ages, the moldy sprinkling of harbinger, the only soil for their graves. I match arm bones with shoulder blades, fingers and toes, legs with each other. Sometimes families get matched, too. And mine is one of those jobs where you wash your hands before you use the toilet. So I wear my old clothing, and I sort and repackage, and I print archival cards, wipe the dust on my thighs. And sometimes in the bath, I will marvel at the many, many tiny bones that are my hands and feet. At the rotational aspect of my forearm, about how my neck pivots fairly well, about how Atlas, the top vertebrae, loyally holds up my skull. On the train home, I can read and forget I am dusty with the ancients until I peel off the remnants of the only tomb they've been allowed, pondering the eventuality of my own dust bones.
Today, I am joined by poet and anthropologist Rose Drew. Thank you for coming here.
Oh, thank you very much for asking me. It's really nice.
Great. Originally from Connecticut, USA, Rose Drew is now a poet, anthropologist, founder, and director of the printing company Stairwell Books, based in York, the UK one. Stairwell Books produces around 10 to 15 books a year and publishes the Dreamcatcher Poetry magazine. She has created a course in human osteology for York College A-level students, has taught science from primary through master's level, and has also given classes on performance. For over 10 years now, she and her husband, Alan Gillett, have run a poetry open mic on the first Tuesday of every month. Her collection of poems, Temporary Safety, published by Fighting Cock Press, centres upon themes of marriage, motherhood, politics, death, and especially life. Her interests and passions include teaching, watching authors find a voice as they embrace their literary career, discussing Caribbean history, and finally reflecting upon what skeletal remains might tell us about how life was in the past. That is quite an eclectic list of interests and activities that, to me, appears like to offer a quite balanced blend of literature and science. So where do these two passions stem from?
I think trying to understand ourselves, perhaps. Well, years ago, I was looking into what program I might do next, and visiting a school in Brooklyn near New York. Yes, you're right. When someone hears my voice, they go, I say, where do you live? And I say, York. Oh, New York. I say, no, old York. York, the original
yes.
York. You know, well, I was in Brooklyn, New York, and this kid comes running into the room, waving a skull, going, I think the child had scurvy. And it just didn't do it for me. I was just like, that's not what we're looking for, the groovy disease. I study us, and I think I write poetry about us, about the everyday people. And then, you know, a little politics thrown in, like, stop that and do that better and be more mindful. But I think I look at how people have lived in the past and what that does mean. And I think to an extent, when you look at the past, it also informs the present and the future. For instance, a friend of mine did a lot of work on chattel slavery, African slavery, as it was apparently practiced just as badly in Connecticut as it was down in the South, because people in Connecticut go, oh, no, we didn't have, we had servants. But he found a lot of these slave graveyards, and because his family's lived in the same state for 200 or 300 years, or 200 and some odd years, he could trace the history, and he says, oh, no, we were terrible. And he would study this. And when you look at how people were living, and you see that they also hunted game in the forest, and they did not just quietly accept their fate, and they broke farm tools, and they were staging rebellions, when you look at this and you translate it to the present, you can say to people, no, you don't come from someone who did nothing but just acquiesce. You come from people who were rebellious the entire time. Your life can be one of action and change, and you can seize control. The same way you look at women. Women were hunters. Women did all sorts. We didn't just hang around and wait for the baby to get off the tit. You know, we did stuff. And when you say that women were as active in the past as they can be now, you're adding a time depth to our ability to be actors in our lives and not just be, you know. So that's why I look at the past that way, and I translate it to the future and the present. And that's what I think I'm doing with poetry. I'm capturing bits of life. For instance, this thing on the 1970s, the 70s love child of the 60s. You know, it wasn't against the law when my boss said, you know, why don't you reach your hands up there and polish the bar lamps? And then he felt me up. And that really wasn't against the law. Oh, these days I'd be like, oh, Harry, I just owned your bar. You're, you know, you're mine, man, you're mine. But that's just not, it just, there was no one, there was no, I had another guy say, sleep with me or you'll lose your job. I told everybody, and I didn't lose my job. But it wasn't against the law. He could have fired me. In fact, Harry did. So those were not against the law. There was nothing I could do.
In fact, exactly in that poem you just mentioned, that little bit there, no cops to call, no laws broken, just yes. How these two sentences stand alone in the stanza like that, it really yes. gave me, as I read it, a sense of danger. But also really struck me how the sentence, you haven't died till your boss feels you up, sort of this also like a death of your own dignity.
Yes.
And in fact, I also noticed later on in the poem, you actually place yourself in the poem with I could sue Harry and his dropped pants. So is this an actual personal experience you write about yourself in your poems?
I actually really do. I it occurred to me recently, someone said, let's write some short stories. And I realized, I don't think I ever write fiction, or I rarely do. I think most of my poems are nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And I think that I might twist the truth a little and add this and do that, but I think for the most part they really are what happened. And yes, I used to take my flute to New York City, and Didi Ramon did bum a smoke off me in those days I smoked, and that is kind of cool. But yeah, in those days it was not against the law. And I mentioned Bill Clinton because he famously dropped his pants to someone who was trying to be his secretary. I forget, his assistant, and she won $700,000.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So, this was before Bill Clinton-esque paydays, and it just was not against the law to proposition a woman, to tell her she would lose her job if she didn't sleep with you, to fire her when she wouldn't sleep with you.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, so people go, oh, we don't need feminism. Yeah, you do. Because that's what I went through. My mother went through worse. Her mother went through worse. And mm-hmm. it just goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to go forward from that, because this is still the rape culture world, which is a poem I probably won't get to, but because there's just swear words in it I can't really excise. But the point is, it is a rape culture world, and men do run the racket.
Right.
So...
But at the end of the poem, there is a sort of, at least I perceived, a feeling of inclusion with everybody turning and, you know, yelling, hey, Billy, and seeing all these people from all these different backgrounds
yes.
just kind of sitting at the same place. So is this your hope for the future? Will we achieve it? Will we achieve the state of harmony, or do you think we haven't achieved it yet? But from your little speech, I don't think we have it yet. But do you think we can strive
yes.
for it?
We can strive for it. We had it briefly. Like I said, the 1960s was theory. And the 1970s, before shoulder pads and greed is good in the 80s, the 1970s was actually the 1960s being put to practice. And one of my favorite memories, it's just a little snippet, was I was driving to Teaneck, New Jersey, across the George Washington Bridge, just from New York into New Jersey. And I went into this fast food restaurant, and there's the young woman behind the counter, little blonde thing, and there's a tall man, and they're having an argument over his order that wasn't correct. He's like, well, I just don't like it. Well, I'm just trying to help you. He was a black man. And he was just an angry customer, and no one thought anything of it. They were like, oh, my God, he's yelling at the girl. It just didn't matter. And I thought, yeah, this is really cool. We can almost get there. And that was somewhere around 79 or 80. And this bar, this pub, the East Gate, we had street people. We had a homeless guy that would talk to himself. We had hetero couples. We had gay couples. And they were beloved. You know, if you've ever seen Cheers, they're like, hey, Norm. This guy was, hey, Billy, the whole bar. He was a gay man. With his lover, Billy. And they were beloved. Mm-hmm. They were just beloved. They were part of the scene. And it was just, and I thought nothing of it, actually, I think, at the time. I just, and now I'm like, oh, my God, look at this. And that was before a lot of race riots happened. It was right before. And there were several things that happened that were horrendous, and it just set everything off. The powers that be get upset when women start to have too much equality, or when things start to even out, or when, you know, the slaves and Paul folks talk to each other. You know, they can't have that. And so I think they allow things to fall apart, or they encourage it, or they put it into play, because it is so much easier to have all of us little folks off our game and hating each other and mm-hmm. angry at Calais instead of realizing that the Tories don't pay tax. You know, GE doesn't pay tax. Coca-Cola doesn't pay tax. They pretend to live in a little tiny office the size of your studio here in the middle of Sweden, so that they have to pay all that money to ship Coca-Cola from A to B, and so they have to save taxes on all that hard work it is to ship it from this office the size of this room to somewhere. It's all a game. It's paperwork. Mm-hmm. And they get away with that. So I really think it's just to keep us all off our game. And I think that the false divisions are embellished and enhanced and encouraged. And I think that we were almost there. And if we were almost there in the 70s, we can get there again. And it is changing. I do think so. I think less care is spent in caring about something as mundane as someone's sexuality. It's just so, it's like your hair color, your eyes. Really, that's you. That's who you are. Does it really matter? And of course, right now it does because it can get you killed, but less so maybe than when I was in my teens. And so I would like to see this continue. And I think it will. I like to think so.
The spirit of wishing for everyone to come together, I think personally that it's also evident in the work you do. If we could turn for a second to The Dust of the Dead that you have also read for us, it really struck me when you describe your actual work in that stanza. I match arm bones with shoulder braids, fingers and toes, and families get matched too.
Yes.
And I thought you do an act of putting together pieces.
Yes.
So do you think that desire to put together, does that also transpire?
I think it must, because I'm trying to give them back some kind of humanity, aren't I? There was a collection of, when I was at Yale, they had a lot of cave burials. Mm-hmm. They just figured they were just a pile of bones. And there's a little tiny, there's a hole that can develop in your breastbone. Mm-hmm. And it's just a normal thing that just happens to happen. And I saw it in several of these individuals in this one cave. So I said, this is a family, because the two-year-old has it and the person who's middle-aged has it, and this really ancient old guy has it. And so it does tend to develop with age, but a little tiny baby had it. So it, to me, it's obviously a family trait. Mm-hmm. So in that case, I could say this is a family group. And so that was a way of looking at that. And I think it's like that guy with the skull. Ooh, look, the kid had scurvy. We're more than just some happenstance of bad luck or poor access to nutrition or things not working out well in the family. We are more than that. And so I think I do look for that. It's one of the reasons I think that I've been falling into studies of disability studies, they call it, which I prefer to look at it as physical impairment in the past. And read Irina Metzler, and she's amazing. And she looks at medieval notions of physical impairment. And based on that, and looking at the skeletons of people who died on the Mary Rose, which is a ship that went down in Portsmouth in 1545, right in front of King Henry VIII, went down. Everyone drowned, mm-hmm. almost. And some bones came up mm-hmm. eventually when they found the wreck. Mm-hmm. And some of those guys have, 60 or 70% of those people have healed broken bones and healed broken hips and all this disaster that ATOS wouldn't say you're not disabled. They would have been on, but they were working. They were members of their community. They had a physical impairment. They weren't disabled. Disability is a social construct.
Right.
And physical impairment is just what you're dealing with. So I'm looking at that in the past now. And I'm very interested in that. And it might be because I walk with a cane sometimes. But I do think it's because these folks can just be presumed or invisible. And it's like when you refer to man as mankind. You sometimes mm-hmm. just have men walking around in the past in your mind. So I'm just trying to re-people the past. So I think I am. I'm trying to put the past back together. And mm-hmm. again, to go forward and say that the past can be this way. I'm not saying anyone who has an impairment should be made to go to work. Because look, they were on Henry's ship working away. But I'm saying if you want to and you can, right. that you should be found a job that fulfills you or certainly lets you spend your time meaningfully with pay at the end of it. I'm a political poet. And I just am, I can't say I'm not. I'm looking at how can we have a better world? And what was it like in the past? And the parts of that are better, they did that then, can we have that now?
Of course.
Yeah.
That's very inspiring. It's a very inspiring work you do. Mm. And as you said, I can see why you call yourself a political poet. Mm. Because in fact, as I was reading your poem, as I was listening to them, they really touch upon very modern themes as well. It's not just about the past, it's also who we are now and what we're doing yes. right now in this instant.
Yes.
And in fact, the No Last Name poem,
oh, yeah,
it touches upon themes of immigration and also, I think, of identity.
Yeah, he had no last name. He's like, oh, I have no last name. I think people didn't. If you find a last name like Butcher and Baker and Cook, I think that's what they did,
yes,
or wherever they were from, and that's fine. But he just says, oh, no, I don't. And to me, that made me spin off into thinking about what does a last name mean? It means you could be traced. And you know, I think women should go back to great-great-grandmother and choose her last name. And if you have a son, he gets dad's last name. If you have a daughter, she gets great-great-grandmother's last name. But so, yeah, this guy has no last name. And didn't seem to bother him. So he needs to be remembered for other things. And I think he's a real person who does these things.
Mm-hmm.
All these people that are there, they're like, it's like York was bombed with our houses and our hospitals and our schools and our studios and things we're doing. And the folks have just been, whatever's left, are sent out to just go. And they're living in these crappy tents. And they're just trying to get somewhere. 60 million people are on the move.
Mm-hmm.
That's the population of the UK.
Yes.
Give or take. And people have to be fitted in somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Of course. They need to be given a chance.
Well, it's like going to change everything. And people go, well, what if it changes the UK? And I'll go, okay. The Cree and the Lenape and the Delaware and the Seneca and any of the other Native American nations you want to talk about had their way of life really changed a little when people flooded across and hordes came mm-hmm. to shore in their little ships and said, we've discovered this land. It was Christopher Columbus Day just yesterday. And of course, loathed that day. Anyway, so the way of life has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a better way to do it. And we now have that chance again. And we have to. We have no choice.
Right. Although you said having a last name means you can be traced, but wouldn't that also mean that you don't have any sort of possible chains from your past that might fetter you down.
Mm.
To me, this man appears that he has endless possibilities
yes.
in front of him, which I felt somewhat reassured by this. It means that somebody coming from somewhere else, because his name is quite exotic,
yes.
can have the possibility, the power to change himself. And in fact, you put special emphasis on his hands.
Yes.
His power to build anything, his future too.
Yes.
But what I found most striking was the question you actually ask the readers and the rest of the society, do we care?
Hmm.
Because you say that he treats the young with particular care, but do we care? Or is this your personal thought on education? Do you think that we care? Or do you think that we should be somewhat re-educated by this, can we call him uncorrupted stranger in matters of humanity?
Oh, he could be anyone. He could be a guy that tends to rip people off. We don't really know. I'm just saying, he's just a human. But I think that the question I'm asking about, do we care, is do we care that there's people who could have all these qualities, just like we claim we have ourselves? Mm-hmm. We teach, we do this, we read, we do poetry. These are folks literally like ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they are now homeless. And they aren't really immigrants so much as they're refugees from a war that my original country and this one had a hand in doing. And even going back around the time of World War II and when we just willy-nilly created countries, let's just make the line here,
mm-hmm.
and put groups together that hated each other and, you know, and said, you're a country now. What? Really? And you don't have water anymore, but that's okay. And and so just get along. And so we've created a lot of this mess.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other things that we had nothing to do with, but it didn't help. So that's what I mean. Do we care? I just did it. I think I put the juxtaposition there because it flowed nice. And when I write poetry, it's often very quick. I'm just going blah, blah, blah. And I might go back later and fix a few words. And they'll tinker sometimes forever. But I think I just did it because there's a juxtaposition. He may teach. He may care. He may be a babysitter. He may be a teacher. He may be a weaver. He may be a builder. He may be the guy that has the best memory ever and does all these things, or he sings. And we don't know what it is that his particular skill or skills are. But putting that aside, do we care? Do we care that he weaves and teaches and sings or does none of the above or is a great shopkeeper or whatever it is he does? Do we care? Or are we just happy because they're like, we'll just dam up the tunnel? And that's really simplistic because then we're not going to get – and I chose truffles on purpose because that's just so – who cares? So I think we do have to ask ourselves what we want. And it is a huge migration of people. And we have to figure that out. I think that's the next thing, next to climate change, and that we've left you guys. Sorry. You know, us old farts have just ruined your lives. But we've left you with all these things to fix, and but they have to be fixed.
We can speculate that this man is waiting for that change to happen, for us to learn a lesson, all of us.
I think so, yeah. because the folks that are there in this tent city mm-hmm. cannot remain there.
Of course.
They have to find a place to go.
Yes. So. I'm afraid we're running out of time a bit, but I want to ask you one last question, and you might hate me for this.
That's all right.
Because it's a bad question for any person that is interested in literature.
Yes.
That question is, we hope this never happens, but should you ever shipwreck and be given the opportunity to bring only one book with you
yes.
on a desert island, which book would you salvage and why?
All right. Well, so this had me thinking, and I looked at several books that I absolutely adore. And then I was talking to a friend of mine, and shout out to Lawrence O'Reilly. He goes, well, gosh, wouldn't you want to have a book on surviving on a desert island? So I must admit, as much as I love Carol Shields, The Stone Diaries, Life-Saving, E.L. Doctorow, brilliant man, you must read him. Gaute Hevold, who's a Norwegian writer. I really think I'd be heading toward the survival handbook, How to Survive in Any Climate, Wild, or at Sea, or How to Survive on a Desert Island. I mean, I want to make a, you know, coconut airplane, you know, or a boat. Yeah. I think, you know.
The modern Robinson Crusoe.
I think that's what I would do. That's what I would do. I'm afraid that's probably the book I would take. It would be How to Survive on a Desert Island by Tough Guides, written by Jim Pipe, and has a crocodile on the front.
That's very sensible, yeah. A very sensible choice. Thank you so much for your
thank
interview
you.
For all your time.
Yes, thank
Have
you.
Have a great day.
Yeah, thank you very much. Bye.